When our children were very young, I had been a very senior leader in a corporate organization, and becoming a full-time mum was an interesting journey.
This is Jill Campbell.
My husband ran his own company, and the navigation of two small boys under the age of three became what we used to call the top trumps game. Who's tiredest? Who's done the most today? Who's been the most stressed today between what was then a full-time working mum and my husband running his organisation? And it moved us to a place where probably our marriage was not comfortable or safe for both of us.
Jill is one of Armiger's most seasoned executive coaches, and she brings her own raw lived experiences, like this one, into her coaching with senior leaders to help them uncover and address the things causing them friction and difficulty.
Alec, being a resource investigator, what he does is look for solutions and things that will help.
Alec is Jill's husband that she's having this top trumps battle with.
He discovered the Arbinger course that someone suggested to him, and he headed off saying, "I'm off to a training course." And I can almost remember me going, "Great, go, goodbye." Yay! And he came back from this course, and he was just fundamentally different. Alec and I had moved, as I said, into this competitive, who's tireder, who's the worst off, who's the saddest. And I'd try and create that argument again because it was where we were safest. And he didn't roll over and just give in. He was very boundaried, but he was also compassionate, and he was honoring where I was, and he would listen to me. And I got more and more frustrated because he was being more and more reasonable. And actually, that space of Alec having learned this outward mindset material and me not, and in fact, me rejecting it, hating it, "What is this stuff you're doing?" went on for about 7 months until eventually I realized that the Alec I was now co-parenting with was really quite an okay kind of person, and came round to maybe I might read the book. But he'd never once, not once, said, "You should read this book." He'd never said, "You should go on this course." He just was different. So that's very reluctantly how I became involved in understanding the outward mindset.
What began as a personal journey for Jill and Alec, practicing an outward mindset within their own marriage, eventually grew into them leading Arbinger UK, where they now help organizations and executives improve collaboration, client relationships, and overall effectiveness. Jill spends most of her time helping very successful, competent senior leaders untangle the often hidden but critical barriers to reach greater success. Today, she's going to walk us through what the coaching journey looks like for these senior leaders. Welcome to Leading Outward, the Arbinger Institute's podcast, where we explore the tools and ideas we've used for over 45 years to help people solve their toughest leadership and organizational challenges by leading with an outward mindset, seeing people as people. I'm McKinley Otterson. So Jill, you know, you said that you resisted it and you were not happy about it, and you kept trying to engage Alec in this same pattern. Why? Why do you think you were so resistant?
I think what I've learned subsequently from that point, almost 15 years ago now, to now where I have joined him in running Arbinger UK, I am the head of leadership development and coaching. I am a full-time outward mindset coach for senior leaders across the UK. I think now, looking back, what I could see was the comfort, the security in the fight that I knew. I wanted to keep fighting. I wanted to keep poking. I wanted to keep going back into the competition because that was the place where the wrong felt safe. I knew how to exist in a fight that was competitive and combative and poor me and isn't he being mean and how come he can't see me. Going into a place where I had to recognize there were some conversations we had to have, there were things we had to navigate that felt far too tricky, was just too frightening.
Yeah.
In the same old cycle was far more comfortable than trying to do it differently.
Mm. Do you find that to be true for the individuals that you coach as well?
Yeah.
Talk about that.
What's become more and more apparent is the patterns of inwardness, where we feel like we've got some control, is the same for all of us. So even if a control pattern might not be useful to us, maybe we're over-rescuing everybody, maybe we always have to be the expert, maybe we're always needing to make progress, they feel like really positive patterns, but all they're doing is protecting us from, for me, what is the core of the inward mindset, which is the fear of being exposed.
Mm.
We all operate from this place that we don't even consciously recognize is happening, which is, am I going to be exposed? Are people going to see I'm not brilliant? I'm not the senior leader material. I'm not kind. Because seeing ourselves as people, sometimes we're not kind. But it's a journey that every senior leader I've worked with has embarked on, yes.
This fear of being exposed could show up in a few places. One might be the areas of our life where we want more control, like a parent who obsesses over how their kids show up in public because they don't want their behavior or appearance to reflect poorly on them. Or maybe it's the places that we avoid, like when you're giving a presentation at work and totally remove the chance for questions because you don't feel like you actually have a handle on what you just presented, and you don't want to be seen as ignorant. There are lots of ways this can surface, but I asked Jill to share what it looks like when a leader begins to recognize this fear of exposure in themselves.
So a leader will share something that's happening in their current experience where they recognize that it's not feeling okay. I mean, it's not necessarily even that it's in conflict or that they are inward. It's that it's just not feeling peaceful, at ease. And then we start working through where we're seeing things as opposed to the things we're doing. So a client yesterday, they were talking about a situation they were in where there was a fallout in a large meeting between six different stakeholders. And my client was the chair of this meeting. And all of these people were MD or equivalent in their organizations. One of the people in the room started acting in a way that was making it really clear they were uncomfortable and unhappy. So we started off by saying, how are you seeing the others? How are you seeing yourself? Now, what starts showing up really quickly in that language when we're coaching is all of these little binary clues. The black or white, the winner or loser, the good person or the bad person. They shouldn't have done this. This was happening and this was wrong, but they tried that and that was right. With my clients who've been with me a long time, they'll literally just start telling the story, get to the first three or four binary words and they'll go, oh, that's what it is. But with someone who's new to it, we start working with our fear, our innate fear of sitting and looking at the parts of us we're either ashamed of or afraid of, or wish were different.
With a client Jill has worked with for a long time, they have awareness around what they're ashamed of, afraid of, or wished was different. But for new clients and for you and I listening, we might not be aware of what those things are for us. So a good place to start is by looking at the situations in our life where we blame. Because we often blame others for the things we are not comfortable with, not okay with in ourselves, the places where we feel a need to be justified.
This justifying space is blame. We have to be working out who's to blame, who's right, who's wrong, who's safe, who's in danger, who can I rescue, who do I need to run away from? As soon as we start to recognize that we're in a place of blame, we can start to see the inward mindset. Am I blaming the other? Yes. Why am I blaming the other? Well, because they're wrong. because they've said this and they've done this and they've done that. Okay. Are we blaming ourselves as well? Yeah. Do you know, I'm really disappointed in the way I handled that meeting. I don't think I chaired it very well. I think I let down everybody else in the room. Right now, we've started to see where the person has moved away from the humanity of other and the humanity of self and the humanity of the whole.
Of course, these statements might all be true. Other people may have shown up in unhelpful ways. They might objectively be wrong. And the way I handled the meeting could really have not been my best. But what Jill's helping me see is that blame makes it harder to see and deal with those realities clearly. Others can be wrong, and I can be ineffective. But blaming reveals that we're not dealing with the reality. We're just justifying our response to it.
Then in the coaching journey, we will start to identify where are the musts. When thinking about the other person, what are their needs, pressures, and challenges? Why might that person be showing up in the way that they are? Why might they be acting in the way they are? Doesn't mean we excuse or allow that to happen, we just see it. With so many clients, they're so afraid, but if I see that fairness might not be the only way, that feels like my world will fall apart. If I see that I'm not the expert in everything, that feels far too frightening. We can just see it. We don't have to do anything about it. We can just see it. Then we do the same with ourselves. In the coaching journey, we get to see it from both sides. What are my needs, pressures, and challenges in that meeting? Where am I showing up in a way that might be excluding or closing down the other person? Then we start working out what the world would look like without the measurement, without the binary language, without the musts, shoulds, and have tos. If we blame ourselves, I didn't do well enough. I wasn't a good enough expert in that meeting. I failed people. We've moved away from how do we solve this? What does the project need? What does the room need? What does this decision need? Who's impacted? How could this happen? Into they're to blame or I'm to blame. Two inward spaces, which our brains do automatically. But the coaching journey is just bringing us back into, let's not have a blame over there. And sometimes the blame isn't even another person. It's our government. It's the system. It's senior leadership. It's society. Bring the blame back from there. Bring the blame back from ourselves. Bring the blame back from anywhere else we're blaming, wherever that might be, to the best of our ability. How do we then see what's needed? What does the project need? What does this problem that we're trying to solve need? And sometimes it's what do the human beings need? So that focus on what's needed outside of blame and self and justification is where we then move to in the coaching space.
We exist in a world of blame. Sometimes we blame others, sometimes we get blamed, sometimes we blame ourselves, sometimes we blame things totally beyond our control like traffic or weather. And it's pretty obvious as to why we blame. It's a way to protect ourselves. So it's worth asking what we're protecting ourselves from.
There's always this preconception that when we are inward, we're being bad. We're being wrong. We're being mean. And in fact, the inward mindset parts of ourselves that are the most pervasive for us and the people we work around are the parts that feel morally justified. You know, the parts of us that are actually deemed by society to be good or useful. So a really simple example, this one can come up an awful lot actually, is as a leader, one of the ways we might identify ourselves is I am fair. I am a fair leader. Everything I do is fair. And that's the underpinning principle of how I operate. Now, fairness as a value and as a principle is obviously a really positive one. It's one that can bring all sorts of benefits. But if we go below the behaviours of fairness, if we start looking at the underlying mindset and the fact that any principle or value or moral that we hold as the only way can fairly quickly become quite inward. For myself, when I am operating from the place of being fair, what I then start doing is measuring myself and others by the binary label, the black or white, the winner or loser, the good person or the bad person version of fair. Where that will show up from leaders is when they are needing other people around them to do what they are calling the fair or the right thing from fairness through their perception. Other people don't see it that way.
Right.
So my leaders are then going, why don't they see this? This is the only fair way. So through their coaching, we start just looking at, well, where might your need for fairness have become inward, have become about your version of how you see the world, not the way that others are seeing it? Because McKinley, your version of what's fair in life, in society, in the world, it's very likely to be different to mine. But until we spot that, we can't change it.
I actually struggle with this, not necessarily fairness, but there are values that as a society we've deemed to be important in some way.
Yeah.
And I have gotten really stuck in this exact thing you're talking about of, but this does matter. It is important that we are this thing or that we engage in this way because this is an important value, right? Is that not important, or how do I still hold it to be important while seeing the people around me? Help me.
Yeah, really, really good question. We have developed from our inward journey in our lives a set of images that make the world feel safe to us, what in Harbinger language we call self-justifying images, being inward towards others or inwards towards ourselves.
Let's unpack what self-justifying images are. They're images we have of ourselves, a picture we come to believe about who we are that we need to portray to others. They're self-justifying because we feel justified not doing anything that the person we imagine ourselves to be would do. So for example, if I have an image of myself that I'm shy, I'm justified in not having to reach out to make people feel welcome. Or if I have an image of myself that I'm important, then I don't have to stoop to do the menial tasks for others that an important person wouldn't have to do. But these two examples are easy because we generally think that it's good to get outside of ourselves and that self-importance is just arrogance at best. Where it gets tricky is where our self-justifying images take on the forms of a virtue. For example, I have a self-justifying image that I'm a hard worker. And as a society, we mostly agree that being hardworking is important. It's something we value. But the problem occurs when my focus shifts from the pursuit of being a hard worker to the pursuit of ensuring that the people around me see me as a hard worker. And this is something I do subconsciously. I'm not thinking to myself, okay, what can I do to make sure the people around me know I'm working hard? But suddenly, in my effort to be perceived as hardworking, I end up pouring my energy into that perception, that image. And when that is my focus, I'm not able to be aware of the people who need to be supported and the work that needs to be done in a way that would actually enable me to show up as a hard worker. And this is true for any virtue or value, like generosity or being compassionate or a good leader. When I am trying to portray myself in a certain way, rather than just simply responding to what people around me need, it corrupts the virtue or value because it's about me.
Now, those rules, those values, those moral codes can be wonderful ways to live, ways that are good for humanity, ways that are good for society, ways that are good for everybody. However, fairness or being gentle or operating from a place of humanity is a perception. And the perception of one person is different to the perception of another. What we teach in Harbinger is that change, how we can start to be different, is around seeing ourselves through the ways we look to other places, be that other humans or the world or to someone's community. And because we're always in relationship with something, as human beings, we're never out of relationship. As soon as we realize if we think there is an us that's right, we have to be making an other that's wrong.
I had a breakthrough moment with this idea in college. I was in a conflict communication class, and my professor gave us a value sort exercise. There were about 100 cards, and each had a different value typed on the card, and we had to sort them into four categories. Very important to me, somewhat important to me, and not important to me. And once we had our sorted piles, the next step was to take just the cards we'd placed in the very important to me category and narrow them down to only our top eight values and then rank them from 1 to 8. And when I looked at my final 8 values, something clicked for me because I thought about the people in my life who I was in most frequent conflict with. And I realized that so many of our disagreements and frustrations with each other likely stemmed from the fact that a value I held as a top priority, something core to who I am, was sitting somewhere in their important pile. It wasn't that they didn't care about it at all. It just didn't hold the same weight for them. And of course, the reverse is true as well. Values that would be in their top 8 were maybe still things I valued, but weren't as central in my life. That's when the concept Jill is talking about came alive for me, that even values, things that are objectively good, can become divisive and inward when we start needing others to live by them in the same way that we do. That's what I did. I had turned my top 8 values into non-negotiables for how others needed to live, which created dissonance because I lost the ability to really take in the person in front of me as a whole person and accept differences as a natural and beautiful part of being a human and being in relationship.
When we are inward, there is a binary calculation. And even if we go, no, I kind of see that they're a bit right and I'm a bit right, it's a kind of 60-40, our mindset underneath that calculation is still, I'm right, I'm safe, the world is safe this way, they're wrong. And if they are right, well, does that make me wrong? And if I'm wrong, Am I safe? Accepting or even seeing that we could both see it completely differently and it still be okay is really frightening. Seeing even our moral codes as potentially inward is frightening for all of us. It's not the way our brain's wired. It's not the way we as humans are wired. Even in that language of inward and outward mindset, it sounds like it's binary. Like we are either inward or we are outward in each relationship and each interaction that we are undertaking. Let's not forget, when we are inward, we can't see all of the options, all of the solutions, all of the connections.
And why is that? Will you explain why that is? Why can't we see that?
When we're caught up in our self-justifying image, so let me use one of mine because I have many. I am the expert in the room. I needed to operate through education, through academia, through my career as the expert in the room. And becoming the expert in the room became more important to me the more senior I got. Because if I had to even consider I might not be the expert in the room, all of my fears about myself, oh, how am I useful in the world? How am I enough in the world? How am I bringing anything to the world? What's my life about? Why am I here? You know, to deep existentialism, if I'm not useful, how do I exist as a human being? So I'm trying to be the expert, which then makes me inward. If anyone shows up in my team or in an auditorium when I'm doing a keynote speech, who asks a question I don't know the answer to, Everything's exposed. If we're going to be able to see others and the world and political leaders and whomever else we're having really strong emotional reactions about as people, we can only do that if we're first able with self-compassion to go, I am a person and I'm not always the expert. And I'm not always fair. And I'm not always right. Being outward asks us to look at ourselves behind the self-deception in the light of our own humanity as well.
Mm.
And if we can't turn off all of those fear triggers about how we need to be seen, we're still expecting others to meet our needs. And that's how the key relationship starts working.
So I'm just even thinking of myself. Most of the time when I am inward, when I'm self-focused, it's because I'm choosing to conveniently ignore all the times that I have done that same thing that I'm frustrated with, all the times that I haven't been prepared for a meeting, or all the times I've been late, or all the times that whatever it is, I just conveniently forget that I did that yesterday, right? So that's really helpful for me, because that's a really great way to get out of that. Just remembering, and it doesn't mean that what's happening is helpful or productive, but what it does mean is I have also been unhelpful and unproductive. And I love what you said too, Jill. It's seeing our own humanity. And I think a lot of times I think about seeing my humanity or other people's humanity as the beautiful things about them. And that's part of it, of course.
It is, yeah.
But part of it, as I'm hearing you say, is just the flawed parts about us. And that's important to identify. And that's so interesting to think about that from a lens of self-compassion, because what we hear often about self-compassion is actually to ignore all the flawed elements of yourself, but really to be truly compassionate to yourself, it's to recognize, I actually am flawed. I actually am not the expert all the time. I have expertise and I can offer so much, but there are times where I do not engage in an expert way.
It. And I don't need to. The binary language of being inward is I must, I should, I have to. They're really good red flags to spot these more inward traits that show up a lot in my coaching, because the people I coach are incredible. They're incredibly wise, brilliant senior leaders who are asking to be able to see the areas where they may be more inward towards others or the world or themselves.
I have one last question for you. I would love for you to answer this as if you were answering this to someone who's about to start coaching. What guidance would you give them as someone who's starting to coach senior leaders like you are doing to be able to be most effective and stay grounded as they help those leaders?
Oh, gosh. Being able to see ourselves through the outward mindset lens and see that we are people. And then sitting with another human being when they might recognize parts of themselves that at one point they thought were the best parts of them. You know, I'm someone who's always fair. And then they suddenly recognize that maybe their value meant that they occluded the value of others, not on purpose, not consciously. As a coach, I think to always hold on to the pain and the discomfort and the ouch of seeing ourselves as not above and not below, but just human, and honoring for the person in front of you that it's okay to be a flawed, beautiful human being and just be in that space with them. I don't think there's any technique or trick I don't think any of us could be an outward mindset coach if we hadn't on some level seen how frightening it is to believe that we are people, or how frightening it is to try and accept that in relationship with other people, the world might not be the way we want it to be. You're okay. Yeah, you're flawed. Welcome to humanity. Me too.
Leading Outward is produced by the Arbinger Institute. To have a conversation about how we can equip you to transform your leaders and organization, schedule a complimentary strategy session at arbinger.com. And whatever came to mind for you while you're listening, a conversation you've been putting off or feedback that needs to be shared, action that you need to take, don't wait. Take that action, because that's how change starts.